Ocean of Drunks. Wow. My name is Bill Sanders, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, I'm sober tonight. And that's the single most important thing that I can share from this podium tonight with you. That it is by the grace of a loving God, the tender, loving care of people like you and me like this, that I have awakened for the last 10,547 mornings without a hangover. Now, knowing how the alcoholic mind works, I'll tell you what that translates to, so you don't spend the next hour. My sobriety date is July 26, 1982. And that was not my first AA meeting. I went to a couple before that, and I want to tell you about that. But first, I want to thank Shirali and the committee for inviting my wife and me. We've had a wonderful weekend so far. I knew it was going to be a good weekend when Nick picked us up at the airport in his Rolls Royce. I've been picked up at the airport with 40-year-old pickup trucks. Thank you, Nick, for your hospitality, and Shirali and all of the committee, and John for all you've done to make us feel so much at home. It's great to make wonderful new friends who have all been very accommodating and warm. And it's nice to connect with old friends like the Roaches over there and with the Patio and so many others. It's wonderful to be with you this weekend. Let me tell you about my first AA meeting. Several years before I got sober, a friend of mine invited me to go to an AA meeting with him. And I went to the meeting with him to support him. He had other motives for wanting me to go, but I went to the meeting, and he had to explain what was taking place in the meeting, and he showed me the, you know, all what the readings were about, and they read those things, and people yab, 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 yab for about an hour, and I didn't understand much of it. Near the end of the meeting, they got this woman up at the front of the room, and everybody was whooping and hollering about this woman, and I said, what's with her? I said, oh, that's Mary. This is her 24th birthday. She looked a lot older than that to me, but they made a big deal about her, and then they handed her something, and I said, what's that? He said, that's her medallion. I said, it looked like a poker chip to me. He said, well, it is, yeah. Then they brought out this little cake and presented it to her, and everybody went nuts. And my friend turned to me and says, if you won't drink for a year, we'll do that for you. I said, let me get this straight. If I don't drink for a year, you'll give me a poker chip and a little cake. I couldn't wait to get out of there. That was my very first AA meeting I ever went to. And I'll tell you about subsequent meetings a little bit later on. I was born in North Georgia, spent most of my life there, and when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I declared to the world that I had been an alcoholic for a good 6 months. Very strange thing about this malady of ours, the longer you stay around, reality creeps in, and that date kept moving backwards and backwards and backwards. I tell you tonight, I believe with all my heart that I was born an alcoholic. I think the ism was there from the very first breath I took. At the age of 15, I mixed booze into the formula and began my journey toward becoming a drunk. Now, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I believed that my problem was alcohol. I'd been sober just a little over 30 days, and my newly acquired sponsor told me to be ready at 6 o'clock in the evening. I'm going to come by and pick you up, and we're going to hear an out-of-town speaker talk. I said, okay. He picked me up, and we went down to a downtown Atlanta hotel. Big crowd there. And they introduced the speaker, and he got up and told them he'd been sober for 24 years. Well, I knew right at the outset this guy was a liar. Nobody goes that long without drinking. And then this guy began to talk about alcoholism as a disease. Now, I always thought I was just crazy or bad. But this guy said, no, you've been sick. Alcoholism is a disease. And then he started talking about it as a disease of perception. And he told me, if your problem is alcohol, then I have a very easy solution. Just don't drink. Aha, got it. That's my problem. I don't drink. I'm going to be fine. But he didn't stop there. He went on to say that if my problem was alcoholism, I better have something to replace that alcohol with when I put that plug in the jug. And he went on to explain a lot of things that were new to me. And after that meeting was over, I walked up to this man and I said, how do you know if your problem is really alcohol? He looked me up and down for about 10 seconds and said, go ask your sponsor, you little puke. I've never forgotten that. Never forgotten that. But I'm here to tell you tonight, I love Alcoholics Anonymous and all that it stands for. And you will see by the time I'm finished why. As I said, I was born, I believe, an alcoholic. I'm typical in that respect, I think, to a lot of fellow sojourners on this trudge of the road of happy destiny. I never felt like I fit. I never felt like I belonged. I always felt like a fifth wheel. I was always feeling like I was on the outside looking in, that I really didn't belong anywhere, and was never felt a part of. Now, last weekend, they held my 50th high school reunion. And if you had asked those 50 or 100 or so people that I graduated, that little graduating class with, they would have said, that's crazy. Bill Sanders was a member of everything that came along. It's true. Joined everything. Church, school, scouts, you named it. I joined it. Didn't belong to anything. Always outside looking in. Felt like everybody that I was around had something that I didn't have. And that went on for me for a number of years until a new friend came into my life. Now, I should tell you that at the age of 13, I went into the profession that was to be my profession for 50 years until I retired a few years ago, and that's the radio and television business. And back then, as a 13-year-old disc jockey, supposedly at that time the youngest DJ in America, that record's long since been broken, but everybody assumed that the smart aleck kid spinning rock and roll records and flapping his gums on the radio was who I was. They did not know that it was a scared little boy hiding behind the anonymity of the microphone, being somebody else. And I made a career out of being somebody else, not just behind the microphone, but out in the real world too. I became a master chameleon. Whoever you wanted to be, that's who I would be. So much so that the time that I found Alcoholics Anonymous, I had completely lost my identity. I had no clue who I was, what I believed, or anything else. Never had a clue. At the age of 15, one Saturday night, a group of friends said, you want to go over to South Carolina and buy some beer and drink? And sure, I said, curiosity, peer pressure, I don't know. But we got in the car and we crossed over the Savannah River from Georgia to South Carolina, and there's a little beer joint over there. You could pull up behind it and honk the horn 3 times, and if you could see over the steering wheel, he'd sell it to you. And we chipped in and bought a case of what I think I remember was Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. Some of you remember that. We came back and sat on the banks of the river, and somebody took a church key to one of those things, opened it up, and handed it to me. This was the days before Pop Tops. And if you're too young to know that that is not a key that opens a church. The guy opened it and handed me that beer, and I turned it up to a great big slug of it. Chug-a-lugged it. And without a doubt, it was the most putrid, god-awful tasting stuff I had ever put in my mouth. And I think that's probably a good explanation of why I only drank six that night. But that night, a certain belief system was set in place with me. First of all, I believed that alcohol affected everyone who drank the same way it affected me. I have long since learned it doesn't. For some people, the first couple of beers, first couple of drinks or whatever doesn't have the little voice that kicks in and says, more, 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 more. Mine always did from that very first night. Also that night was set into motion some statements that people made that I would never understand at all. For example, I still do not and will never understand the person who says, no, one is my limit. Stupid. The one that really, really gets me, and Clancy made reference to it this morning, no more for me, I'm beginning to feel it. That's not where you quit. That's where you get going good. I don't understand those people. I never did understand those people. I never will understand those people. And you know what? They never will understand me. They can't. And I have long since quit trying to make them understand, because they never will. And I thought for a long time that no one would ever understand me and how my mind worked and why I didn't or couldn't drink like other people. Bill, don't you think you've had enough? Enough? No. There is no such thing as enough. Give me more, more, more. I didn't drink that much in high school because I grew up in a very small town. And if my Southern Baptist mother had caught me drinking, I would not have needed Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have needed an undertaker. But then I went off to college. And over the next 4 years, I got a full-blown taste of anonymity because nobody cared how much I drank. Nobody paid any attention to how much I drank. No one cared whether I showed up at classes or not. And so I began my journey toward full-blown alcoholism. Now, I'd like to share some wonderful memories of my college career. I really would love to. By then, I was beginning to suffer from what people in the hills of North Georgia refer to as spells. We have a little less nice-sounding name for them, blackouts. 1961, that was a blackout. I spent 4 years at the University of Georgia, and I stayed in trouble most of the time that I was in college, constantly visiting the dean's office, the dean of men, a wonderful man by the name of Bill Tate. And that man somehow got a bee in his bonnet that he was going to see me graduate with a diploma in my hand if it was the last thing he ever did, and it almost was. But I was constantly having to go to his office and make amends for my shortcomings. And I will avoid going into details on those. One Saturday night, though, a group of us were gathered in a friend's apartment in Atlanta, my roommate and I, and three or four other guys, and we were drinking and clowning and acting like blithering idiots. At about 3 o'clock in the morning, I jumped up and noticed the guy's apartment we're in had an antique gun collection on the wall, and I reached up and grabbed an old long-barreled Colt 22 pistol and dismounted it from the wall and began waving it around, acting like Matt Dillon or Wyatt Earp. Pointed a gun at my roommate and said, stick him up, and he threw up his hands, and I pulled the trigger, and there was a sound like thunder, and in an instant, my roommate was lying on the floor in front of me in a pool of blood. They were to tell us some hours later, the hospital in Athens, Georgia, that my roommate would live, but that he would never walk again. The bullet had severed his spine. A very strange thing happened in the early hours of the next morning. My roommate reached up from a hospital bed and put his hand on my arm and said, "Bill, for God's sake, don't blame yourself. It was an accident. It could just as easily have been the other way around. Don't blame yourself. Please." He had forgiven me immediately, but I did not forgive myself for more than 20 years. Because, you see, I did not know how. It was not until you people gave me the wonder and the magic of the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth steps that I was able to find forgiveness, to find peace, to find serenity, to find release. Instead, I used it as an excuse to crawl deeper into the bottle. And then I began to take pills. And at one point in time, the magic of those began to no longer work, no longer stop the voices. So I went to the college infirmary over a period of weeks, feigning difficulty sleeping, and they gave me a good supply of sleeping pills. And I waited till one Friday afternoon when my new roommate was headed home to show his family his brand new car he just bought. I watched him pull out of the parking lot, and then I sat down on the side of the bed. And I emptied all those little pills out of bottles onto the nightstand, and one by one and two by two swallowed down what was later determined to be somewhere between 60 and 65 sleeping pills, turned out the light, and pulled up the cover. For over 20 years, I believe that it was a huge coincidence that my roommate's brand new car conked out at the city limits of Athens and had to be towed back to the dealership. And he came into that dormitory room, saw me, knew the frame of mind I'd been in, and called an ambulance. I say coincidence because when I use that word, I smile, because I like the definition I heard in this fellowship, that a coincidence is a miracle in which God chooses to remain anonymous. I was taken to the hospital. My stomach was pumped out. And it was determined then and there that I was in serious need of help. Now, I've got to explain very briefly here a Southernism. The word H-E-L-P, help, means that you require some assistance. But the word, if you are in need of help, H-E-P, that means you're in deep doo-doo. And I needed help. Everybody said so. So I began the grand American tradition of visiting the neighborhood shrink. I have no idea how many of those individuals that I saw over the next 20 years or so, but I do know that I left every single one of their offices damning them, because not one single one ever did one single thing to help me or help me. Now, we got this thing around here we call rigorous honesty, which forces me to admit that one or more of them might have been able to help me if I had ever once told them the truth. Think you might have a drinking problem? No, I drink fine. One of the doctors I went to was a very famous doctor. He and his partner had a patient of theirs who they had treated, and they wrote up the case about her in a book called The Three Faces of Eve. And they took that book, and about the time that I was seeing this doctor, a motion picture about that book came out. Joanne Woodward got Best Actress. The movie got Best Picture of the Year. And I was asking my doctor, one of those two doctors involved, all the questions I could about this woman. I wanted to learn all I could about it. And of course, he would tell me very little with the patient-doctor confidentiality. But I wanted to get all the answers that I could about this woman with three personalities inside her body. Because I couldn't help thinking, if I could get my personalities down to just three, see, I have these conventions that go on up here in my head. And I wish I could tell you that after I got sober, they adjourned and went home and never heard from them again. But they're still there. And every once in a while, they'll meet and they'll talk. And they'll talk about whether or not I should drink and then where I should go and who I should see and what I should do. And sometimes if I'm kind of letting things slip in my program, their voices get louder. I have to tell you guys something that it pains me to tell you this, and I hope it doesn't upset you too much. Those voices in my head don't like you. They would like to do their best to keep me away from you. And twice in the almost 29 years that I've been a part of this fellowship, I have gone over a week without going to a meeting. Thankfully, just a couple of times. One of those times I was too sick to get out of bed, could not make it to a meeting. At the end of that week, I was getting argumentative, judgmental, mean, hateful, taking everybody's inventory. Another week that I missed, I was too eaten up with self-importance. I'm too busy, I can't possibly make it to a meeting. Went for a week. End of that week, argumentative, mean, taking everybody's inventory. And I came to the realization that my disease could care less what my motives are. It wants to distance me from you. And another thing I discovered is that every meeting that I missed made missing the next one a little easier. And then one of those voices back there said, "See there, you don't need as many of those meetings as you thought you did." And there was another one right behind me, or right behind him, poised to say, "You don't need meetings at all." Thankfully, I don't let myself get that far away from you so that you keep those voices down quiet for me. As I drank through my career, I finally did exit the University of Georgia. I did it with a diploma in hand. Not sure I earned it or not, but I ain't giving it back. I've had it for over 40 years, and it's mine now. Went to work at a radio station in another city in Georgia, and I met a beautiful young girl a few weeks after I was there, and I thought I needed to probably cut down on my drinking a little bit if I wanted her to be a part of my life. A couple of more dates, discovered that was totally unnecessary. That woman liked to drink just as much as I did. Some months after that, we were married. Now, most people, when you get up in the morning and you tied one on the night before, things can be a little, you go in, the person at the next desk or across the hall looks and says, "Had a rough night last night?" With me, it was different. I had to sign a radio station on the air at 6 o'clock in the morning and sound cheerful. Now, if you want to know what hell is trying to sound cheerful at 6 o'clock in the morning when your mouth tastes like the bottom of a birdcage and your head feels like the Russian army did maneuvers on it the night before. My radio audience never knew how many first morning newscasts they heard me read, lying flat on my back on the floor, microphone pulled down over my face. The only way I could keep the room from going zoom, zoom, zoom. Had a lot of experiences over the 50 years that I was in broadcasting, many of them wonderful, many of them very memorable. Met a lot of wonderful people throughout the radio and television industry. I'll share just one experience that I had that may be of interest. I was working at a radio and television station in Atlanta in the 1960s. And the news director came in one afternoon and said, "Bill, everybody's on assignment. Grab a tape recorder. You got to go downtown and do an interview." "Okay." "Well, no problem." Grab the tape recorder. I said, "Where am I going and who am I interviewing?" "You're going to the Dinkler Plaza Hotel and you're going to interview Lyndon Johnson." "Yeah, ooh." I got in the mobile unit, started downtown, and I said, "You know what? There ain't no way to do this without a little fortification." So I stopped at one of my neighborhood bars and had a couple of quick shooters. Went down to the hotel, got on the elevator, went up to the designated floor, was met at the door by the Secret Service and was frisked. They checked my credentials. practically took my tape recorder apart, ushered me into the parlor of this suite. This giant of a man came over and grabbed me by the hand and said, "Come on in, boy." And I walked in and sat down on a sofa, and there was a coffee table there, and then there was another sofa facing that, and he sat down facing me. And I couldn't help but notice on the table between us there was a couple of glasses and a jug of Jack Daniels. He said, why don't we have a little snort? Sounded good to me. He poured my glass full and he poured his glass full. Now, I should explain to you that at this point, back then you didn't walk in and just sit down and interview the President of the United States. You had to do what was known then, they don't do it today, but then it's the pre-interview interview. That's where you tell him what you're going to ask him and he tells you whether or not he's going to answer it. Had to go through that. So I began to lay out the questions. "No, we're not going to talk about that." "Yeah, that's fine. Bring that up." And I was taking a few sips, and every time I'd get three or four sips down, he'd reach over and fill that glass up again. He was working pretty well on his, too. Started getting hot in that room. All of a sudden, it hit me. "My God, this man's as drunk as you are." About that time, he said, "Turn that thing on. Let's do it." I cranked on the tape recorder, and we started the interview, and it went beautifully. I asked great questions. He had great answers. Everything went smoothly, rocking right along with that interview, until I got down where I asked him a question about his wife, Ladybug. Now, here's where I can always begin to kind of separate the audience by age. There are a lot of you young people sitting there going, "Huh?" Her name was not Ladybug, it was Lady Bird. Thank God he thought it was funnier than y'all did. That's just one of the experiences I had through the years in broadcasting. In later years in my broadcasting career, I had to do a lot of traveling and had to fly a lot of places. I used to say that I was afraid of flying. I've since corrected that. I'm really not afraid of flying. I'm afraid of crashing. So I would always get to the Atlanta airport early, go in the bar and have a couple of snorts before I get on the plane, you know, to kind of fortify myself. Always worked well, too. You know, go out to the airport, go in the bar, sit down. Except sometimes I'd forget to get on the plane. Now, for years, Atlanta's hometown airline, Delta Airlines, had a series of commercials with a particular theme, which ironically I did the voiceover for those television commercials. And the line that I had to use, the only line I had in the entire commercial, was, "Delta is ready when you are." They'll leave you. I'd do what any good drunk do, go get on another airplane, go somewhere else. Call home that night. "How's the convention in New York?" "I don't know. I'm not in New York." "Well, where are you?" "I'm in New Orleans." Along the way, God blessed us with a beautiful little blue-eyed, blonde-haired baby girl. And I and my wife were going to be the model parents. We're going to do all the things good parents do in taking care of their children. And we did. for a period of time, maybe a month. And then we discovered the Grand American Institution of the Babysitter, and we were right back out into the bars. And that little girl grew. By the time she was 5 or 6 years old, something had happened in the course of my disease that I didn't know had happened. You see, my disease outfitted me with something that I call alcoholic blinders. And that is where my disease only allowed me to see what it wanted me to see. An example, I did not see or realize that the only look that was ever in that little 5 or 6 year old girl's eyes was a look of fear and of hate and of disgust. I didn't even notice that my little girl didn't invite friends to spend the night, but she never knew when Dad's coming home in the middle of the night in a drunken rage, smashing furniture, throwing television through plate glass windows, dragging her out of the bed, and emotionally abusing her and demeaning her. But the blinders were firmly in place. Even when my little girl got a new mattress and I was taking the old one off the bed and putting the new one on, and I discovered her diary and did what I shouldn't have done. I opened it and started reading. And the words jumped off the page, "I wish my daddy was dead and maybe there'd be some peace in our home." But the blinders were firmly in place. My drinking, I believe, for many years was that of a social drinker, classy. It took getting sober to realize that if you have to drink in order to be social, you are not a social drinker. I entertained people at some of the fanciest, classiest places in Atlanta. Restaurants where I could walk in the door and be greeted by the tuxedoed maitre d' and call my name and ushered into the cocktail lounge. As I darkened the door of the park cocktail lounge, the bartender would wave, call my name, and by the time I reached my appointed stool, would have my drink sitting in front of me. And I love taking people in there to see that, because I felt like that made a statement. It took getting sober to realize exactly what that statement was. I was also a snob at drinking. I would tell you, the optimum temperature for drinking vodka is 31.5 degrees Fahrenheit. That's wrong. The optimum temperature for drinking vodka is 108 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the temperature underneath the front seat of the car where they kept that bottle. It's not classy when the cop pulls you out of a car you planted into a steel post on the side of an Atlanta city street and hauls you out, cuffs you, puts you in that cage in the back of the cop car and heads off to the jail. And the whole trip there, I'm telling this cop he's making the biggest mistake of his life. He said, "In the first place, I'm not drunk. I've only had 2 beers. You know what? I am convinced that there is this school that when at some time in our drinking career, each and every one of us, when we're in a blackout, we're whisked off to that school, and they only teach one thing there. If you're ever stopped by the cop, it never admit to more than 2 beers. You think about it, watch these cop shows on TV. Guy pull him out of the car, he goes blap on his face, they get him up, "Mister, had a little too much to drink, lost 2 beers. Wife and I were watching one of those cop shows a couple of months ago. They pulled this guy up and propped him up against the car, and he kind of slid down the car and hit the ground. They propped him up again, and he went bloop. They said, "Fella, you had a little too much to drink tonight?" "Oh, I just had 3 beers. I went, "Oh, hell, he missed class." Took me in, put me on that breathalyzer. I blew in that thing and measured 0.28. I told that cop, "That's impossible. There's no way on the face of this earth I could be registered 0.28 on 2 beers. He agreed with me. I can tell you right now, it was the only thing we agreed on. Next was going to court for the DUI. Now, I wonder, some of you may not be through writing your stories. I hope you are. Some of you probably aren't. I want to give you a little bit of friendly, experiential advice. It is not wise, it is not smart, and it is not classy to go to the court for a DUI drunk. Judges don't like it. Now, I had a friend who was a lawyer who said, Bill, don't sweat this. It's your first DUI. All you got to do is when you go into court, they call your name and said, how do you plead? You say, Your Honor, I plead nolo contendere. What's that? He said, that means no contest. What they'll do is slap you on the wrist, give you a fine, send you on your way, and everything will be cool. Don't worry about it. Okay. Well, like everything else in my life, I had to get fortified to go to court. I sat there in that courtroom, seemed like forever, and they called off about 6,000 names. Finally got down to mine, Mr. Sanders, how do you plead? Your Honor, I plead guilty. Judge threw the damn book at me. By now, my wife and I are virtually living almost separate lives. She's drinking in her places, and I was drinking in my places. And all too often, there's a little girl who by now is 10 or 11 years old at home in an apartment in a big city on the phone dialing bars. Is my mom there? Is my dad there? The phone would ring. The bartender would answer. Turn and handed the phone to me, it's your kid. Trembling voice on the other end of the line would say, Daddy, please come home. Where's your mama? I don't know, Daddy. Please come home. I'm scared. And the answer was always the same. I will, sweetheart. I'll be home just as soon as I have one more drink. And you know the rest of that story. Hours later, many drinks later, I would stumble into that apartment. There was that little girl sitting in the corner of her bed, tears streaming down her face. But the blinders were firmly in place. The roller coaster ride of my downward spiral continued. It got to the point when my wife was leaving, I no longer asked where she was going, didn't care. When I left, didn't come home for two or three days, she didn't ask where I'd been, didn't care. So one night she walked out of the house and I'm sitting in my recliner chair with my bottle staring at the TV. She's gone 2 or 3 hours, and she comes walking back into the room. I'm still sitting in that recliner chair, still got my bottle, still staring at the TV, probably trying to decide whether to turn it on or not. And she said, guess where I've been? And I said, who gives who cares? She didn't say a word. She did something really weird. She flipped a white poker chip into my lap. I looked down at it, and I looked back at her, and I looked back at it again, and I said, I don't know where you've been, but if that's all you won, you had a lousy night. She explained to me that that was called a surrender chip at a meeting of the ANA. And I went into an absolute flying pluperfect rage, because I knew beyond any shadow of a doubt there was no way on the face of this earth that that woman was an alcoholic. No way. She just absolutely could not be an alcoholic, because if she was, then she just couldn't be an alcoholic. That's just all there was to it. She didn't care what I thought. Started going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings. Some fool nonsense about 90, 90, and 90-something. I'm waiting for the other shoe to fall. You need this worse than I do. You're bigger drunk. Didn't say a word. Just going to meetings, going to meetings, going to meetings. Not a word. There were a few little clues left around the house. Like I'd go in the bathroom, lift the toilet seat, and there's how it works taped to the lid. you don't believe that, you can ask her. She's right there. No, not good girl. Under my pillow, that thing with 20 questions on it. She did that 3 or 4 times. I never got past the third one. Finally, the other shoe did fall. She finally said, one day, I want you to go to a meeting with me. I said, no way, not going to happen, not in this life. I'd already been to that one before with that 24-year-old chip caker. A few tears, a few deals, and I said, okay, I'm going in my car so I can get away. She said, fine. I said, where are we going? She said, we're going to a place called the 8111 Club. Follow me. I got in my car and I followed behind her and went a few miles from where we lived. She pulled into the driveway of this little house sitting upon the hill in a grove of trees. I passed that house 100 times on the way home from the bar, and as I pulled up that driveway, I had a funny feeling, because I'd go past there and look up there and say, Bill, you ought to get to know the guy that lives in that house, because he obviously has a party every night. Well, that night, old Bill went to the party. Slipped in behind in this little house that had been converted to an AA clubhouse, slipped behind a post in the back of the room, and for the next hour witnessed the biggest bunch of weirdos I'd ever seen in my life. They read all that nonsense at the beginning of the meeting, and they got about through with it, and this guy's doing this. And I'm going, for God's sake, somebody tell that man where the bathroom is. They finally called on him, and he stood up and right out loud told them his name and that he was an alcoholic. I'm thinking, I don't think I'd have told that if I'd have been him. And you know, he then said that he had gotten 3 DUIs. And you know what that bunch of people did? They busted out laughing. The thought went through my mind that I never want to forget. Why are these people laughing? Don't they know what they are? They're alcoholics. They have nothing to laugh about. I tell you, folks, tonight I thank God every day of my life for the laughter that we share in these rooms. Because there's magic and there's power and there is healing in that laughter. And I tell people wherever I go, if you don't have a home group that laughs a lot, go find one that does. I also like to caution newcomers, don't laugh all the time or they'll come get you. Next guy said he had gotten 6 DUIs and been arrested for indecent exposure. That crowd came unglued. And I went, my God, if they knew some of what happened to me, I'd sound like Richard Pryor. Meeting went on, it seemed like forever, and finally everybody jumped up and said the only thing I recognized that hour of the Lord's Prayer, and then I struck out across the parking lot getting out of there as fast as I could. Got about halfway to my car. Something grabbed me by the shoulder that felt like a steel vice. Spun me around and found myself looking up into the face of a man 7 feet 11 inches tall. I'll tell you tonight, he was only 6'6", but he looked a hell of a lot taller that night. I also remembered him from the meeting. He was a little different from the rest of them. Other people had said, my name's Mary, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Tom, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Joe. This guy was different. When they called on him, he stood up and said, howdy, my name's Floyd, and I'm a grateful hillbilly drunk. Give me a break. He started talking about drinking moonshine up in the mountains, about his 5th grade education, about his DUI he got driving the school bus. I'm thinking, my God, why is he telling me all this? The man don't even know who I am. Found out later he knew exactly who I was because she'd been talking about me in those meetings. People come out and get in their cars and they're leaving. Floyd's going, blah, 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 blah. My wife comes out, goes, bye, gets in her car and leaves. And it's me and Floyd. And he talks about getting drunk in the mountains up in the wintertime and falling down on the ground, his face freezing to the ground. And they had to pour coffee on him to get him up. Now, I'm not hearing most of this because I'm busy making a deal with God. Well, Floyd talked on there for, I don't know, 3-4 days. I finally got away from him, got in my car, went home, walked in the house. My wife started to say something. I said, don't open your mouth. I said, don't you ever try to get me back to that nut bin again. And she didn't. And the riot of misery and terror of loneliness and pain got worse and worse and worse. In the afternoon of July 26, 1982, I came out of a week-long blackout drunk. Whole week missing. And when I came out of that drunk, I'm sitting in my old recliner chair. And in my left hand is an empty bottle. And in my right hand, there was a fully loaded and cocked .22 pistol. And I had not remembered picking up either one of them. And the thought going through my head was, is this all there is? If it really is all there is, then I gotta go. And through the fog of that Monday evening at about twilight, there came a voice. The voice of God? Not directly. The voice of an angel? Not exactly. It was the voice of a beautiful, wonderful, lovable, strapping, hillbilly drunk named Floyd. And the words that cut through that pain were simply this. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I expected God to open the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't. But He opened the gates of hell and let me out. And if where I was that evening is any closer to hell on this earth, I hope I never know it. I got up out of that chair and I walked into the bathroom, cleaned myself up as best I could, gargled about a half a bottle of Listerine, drank the rest. You know, it's downright embarrassing for a career alcoholic to have to stand up here and tell you his last drink was Listerine. That's just... But I'm not going to go back and change it. I got out of myself a little bit and got in the car and went back to that little house on the hill and pulled in the driveway and sat down behind that post in the back of the room. Now, the God you people introduced me to, I don't know about yours, but mine has a sense of humor. Because when I peeked around that post at the front of the room, sitting there chairing the meeting with my wife, she didn't see me until the end of the meeting when a man stood up and said, if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired and you want to take this white chip of surrender, come on up. And I got up out of my chair and I took the longest walk I've ever taken in my life to the front of that room. The man pressed a white poker chip into my trembling, sweating hand, and I walked back and sat down. I choose tonight to believe that an old Bill Sanders walked to the front of that room that night and died, and that a new one walked away. Because as I said at the beginning, by the grace of God and the fellowship of this program and good sponsorship, I have not had a drink since that night. And I thank God every day of my life for that. You told me I needed to get a sponsor. I said, no problem. In broadcasting, I've got lots of sponsors. Pick one. You explained that wasn't the kind of sponsor you were talking about. So I decided to find my sponsor scientifically. I looked around for the sweetest, kindest, roly-poliest, white-haired old granddaddy that I could find. One that I knew would pat me on the head on a daily basis and said, golly gee, I've never seen anybody work this program as good as you, and I wouldn't change a thing. Took me a couple of weeks, I found him. Snow-white hair, roly-polier than I am, perpetual smile a mile wide. And I asked a man by the name of Doc Crandall to be my sponsor. Biggest mistake I ever made in my life. I knew I was in trouble that first day. Sure, I'll be your sponsor. Let's talk about the rules. Rules? What rules? No big deal. Just two simple rules. Every morning you wake up, you're going to roll out of that bed onto your knees, and you're going to ask God, as you understand Him, to keep you sober today. And the last thing you're going to do at night before you get back in that bed is get back down there and say thank you. I said, well, now, wait a minute, God. I grew up in Southern Baptist Church. Every time the church doors opened, we were there. No prayer is important. God knows y'all open and close every meeting with it. But, Doc, I got to be honest with you. I'm just not comfortable with this knee business. He said, son, I didn't say a damn thing about you being comfortable. Well, I drew myself up. You couldn't talk to me like that. I had almost 30 days. I said, I thought this was a program of suggestion. He says, it is. I suggest you do what I say or get you another sponsor. I didn't do that, Francis. I don't know. That was just the way we began. Then he gave me that book. Said, I want you to take this book home and I want you to study. I didn't say read. I said study the first 164 pages. And when you get done with that, you come back and we're going to sit down and talk about how you can make those principles in chapter 5 work in your life. I said, okay, I can get into that. Stopped at the office supply store and I got me some highlighters and some sharp pencils and a couple of legal pads. Went home, cleared off my desk and spread it all out and I went to work. I highlighted and I underlined and I made notes in the margin and I wrote in that legal pad and I struck through the steps that didn't have anything to do with me and I jotted down a few I thought of that y'all had missed and about 2.5 weeks later I called him and said, I'm ready to talk. He said, hot dog, come on over. I went over to his house. He reared back in his big old recliner chair and I spread all my stuff out on his coffee table. He said, all right, son, lay it on me. I opened up the book to chapter 5, and I looked down there, and I said, okay, Doc, looking here at this first step, as I interpret, and that's as far as I got, son, that damn step don't need your interpreting. It needs your doing. But what I think it means is, he said, son, it's in English. It says exactly what it means. You look even closer, you'll notice they put little numbers by those steps so smart college boys like you can follow along. God, he was tough. And he was a fanatic about that book. Had a personnel problem at work one time. I went in and said, Doc, got a little personnel problem I'm going to talk to you about. You got a lot of business experience. He said, hang on, before you ask the question, let me ask you one. I said, all right, what? He said, what step are you using on this? I said, oh, No, you misunderstood, Doc. This ain't got nothing to do with steps. I'm talking about real life stuff here. I said, here's my situation. He said, go home and look in the book. I went home, opened up chapter 5. There wasn't a thing in there. It was 12 steps about personnel problems. Went back the next night. I said, Doc, I looked. There wasn't anything in there to answer my question. Let me lay it out. He said, go look again. About the fourth night, he sent me home. I'm driving home saying, God, how'd I get hooked up with that crazy old bastard? So I did what he said. I got the book out and I went down there. That was the answer. Over and over and over again, he sent me back to that book, back to those steps, until one day, the light went on in this thick skull of mine that there is nothing, absolutely nothing, that is going to happen in the life of this alcoholic that there is an answer for it in that book and in those steps. A few years ago, we came out with the fourth edition of the Big Book. Everybody thought it was a big deal except me. And the reason it wasn't a big deal to me is because at the time that fourth edition of the Big Book came out, I had just finished reading the 26th edition of the Big Book. Now, before you think I'm crazy, let me explain. I had read the Big Book from cover to cover at that time 26 times. And every time I read it, they had rewritten that sucker. There's stuff in there that was not there the last time I read it. I was sharing at an AA conference up in Modesto 10 or 15 years ago, or 8 or 10 sometime back, and a little girl came up to me afterwards and said, "Do you really believe that?" And I said, "Honey, let me tell you what I believe. I believe God speaks to me through that book. I believe He reveals Himself of what I need to see, when I need to see it. I also believe He speaks to me through you people. I quite often say that I pray for God's will and then go to a meeting, find out what it is." Now, I would always thought that God would give me the message through a minimum of PhD. No, fifth grade drunk with a fifth grade education. But He knew what I needed when I needed it. And guess what? Almost 29 years later, He still does. I remember the first night that my sponsor told me, "Bill, after the meeting, there's a guy here with a similar background to yours. So stick around after the meeting. We're going to sit and spend a couple hours up there in the front room sharing with him." "Well, Doc, I appreciate you thinking of me, but I've had a rough day. I've got a headache and I'm hungry. Catch me another time." Doc said, "You must have misunderstood me. We're staying after this meeting and we're sharing with this guy." Well, once he explained it that way. But see, I'd been wondering, why do you people care? Why do you care about me? You don't even know who I am. Found out through the years, y'all know me a lot better than I did. But I stayed. And we went to the little front room, the little sofa and everything, and sat down with that guy. And for the next 2.5 hours, I had an experience of a lifetime. I was driving home on my way home that night, and I had to pull over the side of the road because tears were clouding my eyes. Because I realized something, that in that couple of hours, this self-centered, egotistical drunk had gotten out of himself and thought more about another human being than he did himself. And that feeling was unbelievable. I understood what Bill and Bob shared that night on May 11th, 1935, or when they sat in that gatehouse in Athens. I understood what happened between them. Verbal transmission of information back and forth was important, but more important was the language of the heart that took place. The realization of there is another human being who understands, there is another human being that cares, there is another human being that one that says, "I know how you feel, you know they do know how you feel." And I'd heard that line so many times I knew these people were lying to me. I got home that night and I called my sponsor. I said, "That's the greatest feeling I've ever had in my life. Here's what we've got to do. I'll pick you up in the morning. Let's go down to the Fulton County Jail. And we'll get through there, we'll go over to Fulton County Detox. And then when we leave there, we'll go over to Peachford Hospital and get in there." He said, "Whoa, boy." He said, let's talk a little bit about Easy Does It." But I experienced Alcoholics Anonymous that night. I experienced the language of the heart that night. And you know what, folks? I've never been able to get enough of it. It's almost like the disease itself. You want more, you want more, you want more. And I figured out a long time ago that I owe a debt to this fellowship. It's a deep and abiding debt that I feel the absolute necessity to try to pay back. I do it by community service. Within the fellowship, I do it by serving on various committees and things. I do it, hopefully, by sharing when I'm asked to share. But I have discovered something that at first was unnerving about it. Whatever I pay back to this fellowship, I end up getting twice as much in return. And at the end of every day, I am deeper in debt, but richer. And that cycle never ends. In November of 1985, my sponsor, Doc Crandall, went on a 12-step call and never came home. As he and another man struggled to take a shotgun away from a suicidal young man Doc had been trying to help get sober, the gun accidentally discharged. Doc caught the blast full in the stomach and died before he reached the hospital. I sat in his den that night and I felt a loneliness come over me that I hadn't felt in a long time. How can I go on? How can I stay sober without the man who planted me in this fellowship, who dragged me through those steps who kicked my behind when I needed it, who put his arms around my shoulder when I needed it. How can I go on? In the quiet stillness of that evening, the answer came. You'll do it by doing what he taught you to do. And what his sponsor taught him, and his sponsor taught him, and his sponsor before him taught him, all the way back to that night in that gatehouse, and the two broken down drunks said, "Do you think we might stay sober if we help one another?" In the days and weeks and months that were followed Doc's death, I was surrounded by the most wonderful, wonderful bunch of little old snot-nosed sponsees that anybody could ever have. Those little guys dragged me to meetings when I wanted to isolate. They made me share when I wanted to hide. They banged in my door, on my door at home when I wanted to isolate. And they loved me, and they carried me through until I could walk the walk again. And I owe them forever for it. I knew what Doc meant then when he said, "Oh, I get more out of this than you do." Now, for the next year and a half, I did something that I do not recommend to anyone. I sponsored myself. I will not go into any details on that other than to say to you, I woke up one day to discover that I had a fool for a sponsor and a bigger fool for a sponsee. Subsequent to Doc's death, I have had three sponsors. I have buried two more sponsors after Doc. One was a man, wonderful little man in Atlanta by the name of Poet Allison. Another was a wonderful little man from Laguna Niguel, California by the name of Paul O. Many of you, I know me. I did not do what I did that first time around when Paul died. I picked up the phone and the next morning after his death, and I called a man that I'd come to respect over about 15 or so years. And I asked the man, Dick Martin, to be my sponsor. Dick claimed to have a sponsor of his own. Some boo from California. Didn't know it was that same guy who smarted off at me when I was just a few days sober. I believe in sponsorship. You see, I'm still capable of conning myself. I'm still capable of rationalizing murder very easily. So I run everything by my sponsor. Half the time when I call my sponsor, I say, "I got a great idea, son. I'm going to run this by you." Half the time I get halfway through and go, "Oh, never mind." If I get all the way through, he'll usually say, "Are you out of your gourd?" I love sponsorship. I love this fellowship. Now, I want to tell you the rest of the story in closing. In December of 1982, on the day divorce papers were to have been signed, instead my wife and I stood before the same minister who had married us 16 years earlier, and we renewed our vows, and we started all over again. And the last almost 29 years have been magnificent. The wife I tried so hard to get rid of, tonight I can tell you, she is my best friend, my lover, my soulmate, and my pal. I'd rather be with her than any person on the face of this earth. And I know it, and she knows it. And if we make it for another few months, we will have been happily ever after for 45 years. Stand up. Stand up. She was my role model. She showed me the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Without her and getting sober and being in my life, I seriously doubt if I would be standing before you here tonight. 2010 was a difficult year for us. In April of last year, an oncologist looked at my wife and said, "You have a massive malignant tumor in your left lung. We must treat it aggressively." And for the next 8 months, we went through radiation and chemotherapy in massive doses. I watched as my wife got tougher by the minute. I watched her bravery and her courage and her strength and her determination that seemed to double every day. I watched as she reached out to people, and I watched as the people of Alcoholics Anonymous surrounded us and loved us and prayed for us and catered to us and took us places. Nobody else in the world but us can experience this kind of love and this kind of care. We went on a little website called the Caring Bridge, and some of you may be familiar with it, where you put out the word on conditions so you don't have to repeat it on a phone call 100 times. We got prayer comments and good wishes from over 6,000 people from one end of the world to the other, from Ireland, from Japan, from Australia, from Iceland, from places that I didn't even know where they were, all because of this wonderful fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. 2010 was a year of growth for both of us. We realized the magic and power of this program and of the people in it. We learned what the full, unadulterated meaning of unconditional love is all about. And then in January of this year, when a CAT scan was run, we fully learned the meaning of the word gratitude when the oncologist looked into our face and said two words: cancer free. A little girl who wrote in her diary, "I wish my daddy was dead." A number of years ago, she let me walk her down the aisle of a church. And she said, "Dad," I cried all the way down the aisle, of course. She said, "Dad, at the reception, I want to have the first dance with my new husband, but I want to have the second dance with you." I said, "Okay, honey. But I tell you what, tell me what music we're going to dance to so I can practice a little bit with your mom. Because, you see, I don't dance as well today as I never did." And she said, "No, I'm not going to tell you. It won't be a surprise." I watched as the prince and princess had their first dance together. And then my little girl came and stood in front of me, and she reached out her hands. And I looked into those eyes. And instead of fear and hate and disgust, I saw love and I saw respect. And she led me onto the dance floor, and the music began. And the words of the song were, "Did you ever know that you're my hero? And everything I want to be, I can fly higher than an eagle. You're the wind beneath my wings." What a miracle had been worked in the lives of this family that had been ripped and shredded and torn apart by the insidious, relentless, unforgiving, never-quitting disease called alcoholism. And yet, meeting by meeting, prayer by prayer, step by step, sponsor by sponsor, you people and God had put this family back together again. That little girl who wrote, "I wish my daddy was dead," and I today have a wonderful relationship. She has given my wife Marlene and me two beautiful, beautiful baby boys. She even gave one of them my name. I was not a very good father, but I'm going to tell you something. I'm a damn good granddaddy. I never give those two boys anything in the world they don't want. As I said, those voices in my head don't like it when I'm with you people. But I'm going to tell you something. I like me better when I'm with you. And that's why I love being around drunks, and why I love going to conventions and the roundups and the powwows. It's why I love being a part of this most wonderful fellowship in the world and one of the greatest gifts that I think God ever gave mankind. So it should not surprise any of you that I would conclude by tonight by simply saying, did you ever know that you are my heroes You're everything I've ever wanted, everything I've ever searched for, or that I've ever wanted to be. And together, I believe that every single one of us, together, can soar like eagles, because He's the wind beneath our wings. God bless you. Thank you for a wonderful weekend.